It's Abu here. You're probably wondering, what's different around here? And the answer is everything. I took the last year off, not just from podcasting, but from everything. I needed a reset. Last year was one of the hardest years of my life. And as you know, life doesn't just throw one thing at a time at you. It hits you with everything all at once. I hit a mental roadblock, my business hit a wall, and then I faced an unimaginable loss of someone I deeply loved. I had a reset. I went deep, asking myself, what's wrong with me? What did I do to deserve this? I struggled with grief, with loss, with relationships, with business, and family. I was operating from a place of seeking permission. Permission to let go, permission to step back, permission to prioritize myself. And then it hit me. You don't need anyone's approval to take the next step. You don't need permission to be a CEO. But you do need the tools, the mindset, and the support to lead in a way that doesn't cost you your peace. It took me over a decade to truly figure this out. And now I'm ready to keep going, sharing what's worked, what hasn't, and everything I'm still learning along the way. So if you're ready, and I know I am, hit subscribe, leave a review, and share this with someone who needs to hear it. Because this isn't just my journey, it's ours. Lastly, I just want to thank everyone that reached out to me over the last year just to check on me, make sure I was doing good. I truly appreciate the support, and I look forward to continue building more deep connections with you all. This is the Powered AF Podcast, a show about visionaries, high performers, and entrepreneurs, and their stories on how they push past fear, overcome imposter syndrome, and navigate through the mental roadblocks in order to achieve the highest level of success. And I'm your host, Abu Fofana. In this week's episode, we're going to be talking to Jaysa. Jaysa sits at the intersection of capital, of entrepreneurship, of bootstrapping, thinking about raising funds. She's a venture capitalist, and we're going to be interviewing her. And she's going to tell you a little bit about her and what she does and adding value to companies and also seeking the next best idea to invest in as well. She's going to give a lot of good insight for you and those that are thinking about raising funding or the questions that you need to start asking yourself. Am I ready to raise funding as well? And then she's also going to give a different perspective around bootstrapping. Those that decide, hey, I actually don't want to raise venture capital. I actually want to bootstrap my business. So this episode is filled with a lot of gems, a lot of wisdom, a lot of nuggets, and a lot of action items that you could apply to wherever you are in your business today. So again, let's dive into the episode. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. It is an honor to be here.
It's been a long time coming.
Right, exactly. And I feel like the least I can do is be a guest and bless you with my support in this way. So I'm super happy, one, to be invited to be part of what you're building, and then to also be able to share my story and use it to help the people who you speak to.
No, and I greatly appreciate you for coming through, especially in the clutch. And I think, you know, your story is one that needs to be told, because there are a lot of entrepreneurs, people thinking about getting business, that what you could share with them could really help them. So before we dive into the interview further, can you tell us a little bit about, you know, who you are and your story to where you got to where you are right now?
Sure. So my name is Jaysa. I grew up in Atlanta. I'm of Jamaican heritage. Very proud of that. Very much a around the way girl, love my city. Just moved back here from New York. I spent the past 3 to 4 years in New York building my career in venture capital. And so I've been in the field specifically with the mission to use venture capital as a means of creating generational wealth for Black entrepreneurs and other underrepresented groups and communities that have been excluded from reaping the benefits of ownership and equity. So that's my mission. I am part owner of a juice bar here in Atlanta. Have to shout them out, Juice Heads ATL. And I also currently work as the head of partnerships for HBCU VC, which is a nonprofit that is focused on directing how capital is allocated to Black, Latinx, and Indigenous investors. And they do that by creating career opportunities for HBCU students and other underrepresented underrepresented groups to work in the field. And also, I am a venture partner at Nomus Ventures, which is a VC fund focused on fintech, AI, ML, as well as marketplaces. So between those different responsibilities, I'm doing the work and helping people succeed in entrepreneurship.
So basically, you're doing a lot of amazing things. I don't even know how you are finding the time to do all of these amazing things. And there's so much I want to touch upon based on the things that you said and the things that you're doing. But for those of us that, you know, people always hear the term VC, venture capital. Like, what do they actually do?
Yeah, that's a great question. So venture capital is a means of financing and getting funding for early stage startups and companies. So it is capital in exchange for equity that fuels growth. I think that's the most simple, fundamental way to understand it. And that growth leads to returns in capital, which is the big driver of why people go down this road, because you give up ownership in your company to have outsized returns further down the road. It is typically a long-term relationship between an investor and an entrepreneur. And it's something where you're working with this investor to scale your company. And it's really about high growth, high potential business models, and being able to fuel that with outside funding.
Because I hear it all the time, and I also hear the other side. People don't really know. They're like, what's a VC, or am I ready for a VC? Now, because you're in this position now, like, is this something that you always known about or knew that you want to do? Because the neighborhoods I grew up in, you know, if you wanted to fundraise, you'd go to friends and family, right? So was this the path that you were always set on?
So definitely same for me. VC was not a word that or a concept that I was familiar with growing up. Entrepreneurship in general was something I understood to be something that was for rich people. Rich people were entrepreneurs because they could afford to fail. And a lot of cases, people who look like me and came from where I grew up, they didn't have access to that type of risk. And so entrepreneurship really does entail that, being able to take risks, hopefully calculated ones, but a lot of times those risks are easier to take when you have the financing to be able to do that. So with venture capital, it was something I actually got exposure to in college. Before that, I actually wanted to be an ambassador. And so I was preparing to take the foreign service exam, and I was trying to get fluent in Arabic, and I just had a completely different path. But then I realized what I really wanted was to travel on my company's dime. And I realized I didn't necessarily have to be an ambassador to do that. So I discovered venture capital, and I was like, oh, this is how rich people get rich. And I felt like I had a responsibility as someone who had access to the education and the knowledge to be able to understand that work, to then take it back to my community and be able to build companies with founders and entrepreneurs who didn't necessarily have the knowledge of how to get from being a small business to being a multi-million dollar empire. So I started that work with Juice Heads, and that momentum and traction led me to roles where I was able to work with emerging managers at hedge funds, and then also family offices, transitioning into venture capital from there. So my journey has been pretty fluid and has allowed me to have a variety of experiences that have shaped me being able to help entrepreneurs from multiple angles.
Now, it sounds like, you know, you were always ready for it. Like, did you feel like you, because a lot of the industries I'm noticing, whether it's tech or VC, we think about Silicon Valley, it's a lot of white men. Like, so did you notice that when you walked in the industry, and did you have imposter syndrome at times as you were trying to navigate and then bridge the gateway between, you know, underrepresented founders as well? And so how did you feel assuming that role and these responsibilities?
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. And it's something that I felt from day one. When I moved to New York, I really hit the ground running, going to pitch events, demo days, and any type of setting where I could meet entrepreneurs and other investors. And with me being not just a Black woman, also a young Black woman, also an attractive young Black woman, like, there were just so many times where I'm in the room and there is an automatic assumption that I'm an intern, that I'm a temp, that I'm getting coffee and food in some capacity. And it took a long time for me to figure out the most professional but also assertive way to take up space in the room and really be able to show why I'm there, and to do it in a way where I don't even have to address the ignorance. Like, I can just come with the skill and with the polish and they have no question about why I'm there. And I remember one of the first events that I went to in New York, I actually was talking to an older white man and I told him that I was looking to be a VC. And he said, oh, VC is a bunch of old white guys who went to Ivy League schools and you don't look like an old white guy who went to a Ivy League school. So why do you want to do that? What makes you think you can do that? And his comment was at first very discouraging and almost offensive, but he actually ended up being someone who I was able to get a lot of support from. He was honestly just giving me the reality of his experience and really challenging me to be able to answer that question. And I was able to do that in a way where he respected it and was invested in seeing me be successful. And so I found ways to turn those hurdles into opportunities for allyship, opportunities for mentorship, opportunities for really just that type of ecosystem of support where you're not in a place where you're trying to do it alone. And that's something that I always say about my career. Like, my ability to be successful in this industry is because of community. And so that's something that drives everything that I do.
Yeah, and I think that's something that is really, really important as well. When you're dealing with imposter syndrome, you know, one really good method you could use is, you know, trying to find a tribe and community of other people that could guide you through and navigate through that, especially when it's a landscape that you've never been in before. So I think that's really important what you did. And I know for myself and other entrepreneurs, we're always looking for, well, am I supposed to be in the room? You know, how do I know I'm supposed to be in the room? And I always tell people, well, you know, you were invited. You know, if you're invited, you don't want to think about how you got in there. Now you want to just focus on, okay, what am I going to do to stand out now that I'm in the room, you know, because I belong here. And so there's this mindset shift that you have to be able to do as an entrepreneur in order to really, you know, deal with this imposter syndrome that we all experience in these roles or these new rooms that we're granted or entered into as well. When you are dealing with, you know, these imposter syndromes, are there any other challenges that you had to face? I know you talked about being a woman in this space. I have a tribe and community of a lot of women and founders that I serve. So what are those challenges as you navigate as a Black woman through the space?
Yeah, I think that really comes down to how you communicate in overcoming some of those challenges of imposter syndrome, because automatically you're going to have people who are coming into a conversation with you with their own assumptions, with their own biases, and you have to be prepared to address those things in a way that is very first word that comes to mind is posh, but that just really shows that you have character and that shows that you are unbothered more than anything. And when I'm in a room and I'm in a situation where I'm dealing with someone who is responding to me or reacting to me with that type of animosity or just dismissal, the first thing that I do is make sure that I am showing up in a way where they can't say that I did anything that was inappropriate or I did anything that was unprofessional. The first thing that I'm going to do is be the bigger person in the room. And at the end of the day, they have to sit with how they behaved versus having the ability to say that I did anything that stoop to their level.
And I think that, you know, we always have to be better, right? The quotes we hear growing up from our parents, you have to be 10 times better, you know? And so, you know, it's unfortunate and has to be that way. But we could also leverage it to our advantage and in order and how we show up and, you know, how we also the peers around us who look like us, how we help others around us too. So I think that's really important. Now, for those listening in right now, they probably think you came out the womb, you know, as this person. And so what was your first job out of college? Was it, you know, VC right away or?
No. So the first job that I took right out of school was actually at PBS. And so I was working in the advancement or development department of PBS, and it was a temporary role. It was something that I was doing as I was transitioning from living in Hawaii, which is where I was for the past 3 years. So I was working there, knew that it was a temporary opportunity. And what I was really doing is trying to build a public speaking business. So I was working there to get the bills paid, but I was really focused on doing public speaking engagements, and the work was so easy that I could just knock it out, and then I would be doing the prep work for the engagements that I was getting or creating my courses and the content that I was doing in marketing so that I could have opportunities to work with, at the time I was targeting nonprofits and organizations that were serving young women. And so right out of college, I really thought that I wanted to be a public speaker. And so I was building that type of entrepreneurship model. And I had great opportunities. But what I found right away is that people won't always get the vision. And of course, this podcast is focused on visionaries, so I'm sure people can relate to that. I remember I was talking to my boss who, you know, she had her perception of who I was versus the experience that she had being much older and having more experience in the field. And I told her that I needed to leave a bit early because I had a speaking engagement. And she literally looked at me with confusion and said, "What do you have to say?" at such a young age. And the fact that she put "at a young age," it softened the blow a little bit because I could understand the context of her being older and her probably looking at me as a child. And she's like, "Who's giving you a microphone?" But I just remember in that moment feeling that imposter syndrome because I'm already nervous that this is something that I'm stepping into and it's something I'm unfamiliar with and I'm trying to create space for myself. And I remember I just told her, I was like, "You'll find out." You'll find out. And that's the mentality you have to go into when you're dealing with adversaries. Like, don't believe me, just watch.
Right. Absolutely. And it's funny because it reminds me of a personal story. I was getting ready to release a book, and I had written this book. I was getting to release it. I sent it out to, I think, 5 friends, and I got positive feedback from all 4 out of 5. And then one sends me feedback, and they were like, "You haven't lived life yet. Like, what do you have to say? Like, who's going to go buy this book?" And literally, because at that time, my mindset wasn't as strong as it is now. So I got 4 positive feedback out of 5. And that one prevented me from putting the book. I was like, "Wait, you know what? What do I have to say? Maybe I need to, you know, live life for 40 more years in order to say something." But we have to recognize the experiences that we have, there are other people that don't have them, right? There are other people that, you know, are 2 steps behind, 10 steps behind. And if we could help one another, especially our peers, navigate, then that story should be told. You know, you should be a teacher, right? You should be a mentor to somebody. And so I think that's really important. The other thing you talked about was sort of this nurturing. You know, what is nurturing your environment? And your environment's really, really important. And I remember early on, you talked about one of the biggest reasons you got into VC is because you wanted to be the bridge, right? You wanted to be the bridge and take the things that you were learning, going back to the communities that you grew up in and saying, "Okay, I know there are business opportunities here too." Everyone that has business ideas all don't live in Silicon Valley or specific, you know, wealthy areas. There are people that have ideas that live outside of these communities. So how do I bridge the gap between the two? So how does someone know, because you've worked with a lot of companies now, how does someone know they're ready for VC funding or when they should approach for VC funding?
Yeah, that's a great question because I do believe that VC funding is not for everyone. And so you have to have an understanding of where you see your company 5 to 10 years from now and what the trajectory looks like to be able to get there. And also as an entrepreneur, what you want. How long do you see yourself working with this company? Is it something that you always want to be in a leadership position with? Or is it something that you want to be able to take the proceeds and reap the benefits from the work that you put in and move on to something else? And so venture capital funding is something that allows you to work with a partner that allows you to get the financing that you need to scale faster. And then it puts you in a position to be able to have some type of transaction or shift in ownership where the valuation of your company has increased and there's more opportunity that investors see in your company. Now you have more people coming to the table, but at what cost? Are you willing to give up ownership? Are you willing to give up control in order to reach those types of milestones? And it's not necessarily a guarantee that that funding will get you there. A lot of companies get capital and then they're not actually able to execute on the milestones that they intended to reach with that funding. And then there's the other end of the spectrum where some founders scale without any VC money at all. And that's a path bootstrapping that a lot of entrepreneurs choose because they don't want to have someone else at the table helping them make decisions and having a say when they're not actually in an operating role. So you have to figure out the vision that you have for how how you want your company to be run. And then also from a business model perspective, you want to make sure that the solution, whatever you're building, is addressing a problem that is VC market size. Like when you're looking at VC opportunities, the return expectations are in the billions. And every investor is looking to hit a home run to that degree. So if you don't feel like your company has that type of potential, then you want to consider other options. Are there other ways that I can do this? And you have to be willing to think beyond the current vision that you have to say, how can this business model, how can this solution expand into different verticals, into different sectors? How can I take this product and bring it to new customer groups? And how do I further develop that to be able to leverage customer referrals to enter new markets? So there are just so many pathways that you can take when it comes to scale. And I think that venture capital is just really one of those options. And so determining whether or not you're ready for it really comes down to the vision that you have and beginning with the end in mind and saying, do I see myself still being involved in this company 5 to 10 years down the road? Could I benefit from having a partner? Say, for example, if you're a hair care brand, can I benefit from having a partner who knows all the major retailers or is well-versed in supply chain and can help me achieve economies of scale? So if you need those type of resources, then venture capital is the right path for you. But if you're in a situation where you feel like you have the formula, you have the secret sauce, and anyone coming into that would not necessarily add strategic value, then bootstrapping may be a better option for you. Or if you want to work with capital that's less institutional, there's angel investors and high net worth individuals who you can work with who provide similar support without the stringencies around how you have to scale, what type of financial milestones you need to reach within a certain time period in order to be seen as a profitable investment.
Yeah, and I think you touched upon a lot, whether it's getting funding, outside funding, or bootstrapping. Me specifically, you know, I'm a big proponent on bootstrapping, especially to a certain point. Now, there's someone listening in right now that hasn't started a business. They have an idea and they think it needs to get VC funding right now. And I see this happening all the time. I always tell entrepreneurs, hey, test out your idea, you know, your theory. Go out there, try to sell it to somebody, try to get customer data, because these things are possible without VC. So for that person that has an idea and saying, oh, all I need is someone to fund it and is not starting anything, like what sort of advice do you have for them? Like, should they still be waiting for a big $1 million check to come in with just an idea?
I would say proof of concept when it comes to that. And I know some entrepreneurs hate to hear that, especially Black entrepreneurs, because it's true. A lot of counterparts in the industry, they have an idea, they get a lot of funding, and they create a $1 billion company within 3 years. And a lot of that is happening where valuations are just so inflated in the industry, it's pretty ridiculous right now. But the reality is that it doesn't work that way in most cases for Black entrepreneurs. And you have to have some type of proof of concept. You have to have some type of traction and momentum already built before anyone would consider giving you capital, because they're looking at you as a risk rather than an opportunity first. And that's just the reality of how the space works. So you have to be prepared to have conversations that are going in that direction. But what I really think matters is that you have an understanding of what your opportunity is, like what you're building and the potential that comes with that. Because you can have an idea, and the way that you're thinking about the idea is different than how that investor is thinking about it. And so they may offer you money, but that money may not be good money. And so you can take that deal early without really understanding the direction and the vision that you have for the company. And then you end up getting obligated to perform or execute in a direction that doesn't actually match the vision that you have. So I'm a big advocate for actually taking the time to test the market, to get proof of concept, to build an MVP and test it with your customer, and then pivot or make any changes that you need, integrating that feedback so that you have an understanding of what potential hurdles you'll experience as you scale, and you can make the informed decision about whether or not that's the path you want to go down. When you bring an investor to the table very early, it limits your ability to have that freedom and flexibility, because you're now working with someone who is invested in a particular direction for the company.
Yeah. And for someone that is, let's say, at that stage and saying, you know what, I'm ready to get VC funding, where would they go? Like, what resources are out there? Like, could they go to Google and type up and find a sort of a list of places they could explore? Where would they go? Or do they need to book a flight to San Francisco? Do all VCs live there? Right. And so
What would you recommend as a resource for someone who, you know, has gone past the idea phase, they have proof of concept, and you are right, we do have to do more, right? We do have to do more because that's what the market shows. It's not right. These aren't things we're saying is right, but we're saying when there's a game, you have to learn how to navigate through that in order to position yourself. Because later on, maybe you now have the capital and you could change some of how people get funding. So what are some of the resources that you would suggest for that individual that is ready?
Yeah, that's a great question. And first and foremost, I have to do a plug for HBCU VC because we have the lab fund that we've launched last year and are continuing to bring in new founders and companies. And that's a $1 million initiative where we're filling in the gap of the friends and family round. A lot of Black entrepreneurs and underrepresented founders, they don't have access to a community that is able to give them those first checks that help get a company off the ground. So with HBCU VC's lab fund, we are allowing the student investors or the like recent grad investors who go through our programs an opportunity to be able to select companies and provide them with funding, philanthropic funding that is equity free. So free money to some degree. And you're able to apply on a rolling basis. So no application deadline to really have that pressure. But outside of that, because that's really like an early first check, you know, first money in. But when you're talking at the VC scale of getting that first million or that first few million to be able to scale your company, you're really looking at, in my opinion, angel investors. I think that's the best road to go down for first money in because it allows you to have a strategically aligned investor who works with your company without the rigidness that comes with working with a VC investor who has a certain time horizon where they're trying to make a return and they're just basically making you a asset of theirs rather than with an angel investor. A lot of times you'll get more personalized attention, whereas with a VC fund, in most cases, you're going to be one of many. So I'm a huge advocate for working with angel investors at the early stage. If you do insist on working with VCs, and it's so funny that I'm kind of saying it as a not the first option, and I'm working in VC, but I just know that I've seen companies have the most success when they have a variety of players at the table and not just going directly to a VC. But if you are specifically looking for venture capital investors, there are a lot of networks now. There really hasn't been a better time to be a Black founder in venture capital because all of these VC funds are being held accountable for their lack of diversity in their investment portfolios, and they're now actively seeking to meet and fund investors, invest in underrepresented entrepreneurs. So there are networking groups like Afrotech that I think do a great job. I just went to their happy hour yesterday here in Atlanta, where you have people in the room who are doing the work and, you know, everybody's vibing. It's a good little Black excellence scene, and it's a good way to get plugged in with people in the ecosystem. But like you said, a lot of VCs are in particular cities like San Francisco and New York. So to some degree, it does require you to have relationships in those areas to be able to tap into those people. A lot of investors live on Twitter, and I think that's a great way to be able to engage. If you share what your company is doing and you provide updates through social media, specifically Twitter and LinkedIn, I know people who have gotten a lot of deal opportunities that way. And then also there are networks within corporations now. So if you work for a corporation that has a corporate venture capital arm, they're always looking to invest in entrepreneurs who are within their ecosystem. The same way Google Ventures will invest in somebody who's a former Google employee. If you're working for Citi and you have a fintech idea, you want to be able to leverage those corporate relationships. The emerging managers who I know in the space are seeing a lot of success in building their funds are really getting support from corporate venture capitalists. And I want to share that same opportunity to founders to look outside of the partners who are getting a bunch of deal flow and don't have a track record for investing in diverse founders. And rather than going with some of the top tier investors who don't have a background of investing in diverse founders historically, you want to be able to make sure that you're building relationship with investors who are value aligned and have a mandate or a focus on solving for this problem. And you can see that a lot of big corporations have made those type of commitments these days. And so that's where I would start if you're pursuing venture capital funding in particular.
We talked about, you know, sort of this process of raising VC, you know, when you should think about raising VC, the risk and rewards of it. Now, when we think about the risk and reward from the founder's point of view, from the entrepreneur that's receiving this money, because I'll go on Instagram and I'll see individuals posting, oh, I raised all this money. And in some people's mind, they think that money goes into that founder's pocket. They're set for life. You know, they're taken care of for generations and generations. But what is it actually like when that founder does decide to accept the money? It should be a celebration, but what isn't not being seen on Instagram?
Right. Yeah, that capital is fuel. So it's not going to the founder. It may be going to expand the team and hire and bring on new people, but it's definitely not a personal $1 million investment. It's an investment that fuels the growth of the company. So with that $1 million, you're expected to now scale your revenue to $5 million to $10 million in order for it to be seen as a positive signal. So when you need additional capital, you can come back and say that $1 million that you put into my company is now worth X, Y, and Z because my company has now made more money and now my company is worth X, Y, and Z valuation. So definitely getting the money is the first problem that you have. And then after that, you have the challenges of execution and making sure that you use that capital in a way that actually scales your company. And that looks like, one, just like I said before, hiring a team and developing a work culture. I think that's the most underestimated challenge that a lot of founders face. They don't anticipate how difficult that can be and how costly the mistakes are. So that is one area of focus that I really encourage. And also in a lot of cases, especially with the consumer companies that I've worked with, they will use that first money in to fuel inventory and being able to meet the demands of the retailers or whatever customers they have. And there are challenges associated with that, with how you scale. Like if you take that $1 million and you open 3 new brick and mortar locations for your brand, now you're bringing on a lot of overhead that comes with that. And if you're not fueling your revenue and actually performing profitably across those 3 stores, you now have, say, 4 locations, if you originally had 1, where none of them are operating profitably, and that $1 million is split across all 4, and you've burnt through that before you even know it. So I think founders at the early stage with that first money in really have to be mindful of burn rate and how they are spending cash and what their overall cash flow looks like with the new growth that they're trying to bring on. Because a lot of times people will use the money to fuel growth and they don't take into consideration the overhead expenses that come with that. So they may increase their revenue, but if they're not doing it in a sustainable way, they're still unprofitable. And so in the eyes of an investor, you're not successful, even if you've been able to generate additional revenue, which is an example in the situation of WeWork, where they were a company that was fueling growth and opening new locations all over the world. And they were seen as this successful enterprise. But the reality is that they were having a lot of internal issues because they weren't building in a way that made sense from a capital resource perspective. They were spending so excessively that they weren't actually generating returns for their investors.
Right. And I think that it's important to know that, like, when you decide to take someone else's money, right, like, you're responsible for whatever those terms are that you agreed upon, especially when it's an institution, especially when it's, you know, VC capital, etc. Now, when it's just your friends and family, sometimes that may look different, right? That may look different, the risks associated with that. Now, what's the mental side of this, right? Because I've been in scale mode and it takes a toll on you when you are an entrepreneur and you're making, let's say, $10,000 a month consistently. It's great. Then you accept $500,000 and now you have to grow larger than that. What's the mental toll that you see working with these entrepreneurs that it has on them? Like, are they sleeping, right? Are they, you know, eating? Are they, you know, do they end up having to get a therapist? Maybe is that even in the terms that they have to see someone, you know, weekly in order to make sure that they're okay? So what's the mental toll that, you know, this takes on you when you decide to scale and when you decide to accept outside money as well?
Yeah, that is a fantastic question. And I feel like I've seen the entire spectrum. I've seen people who are really good at self-care and they know when to check out and they know how to delegate and they have a support system that is so strong because they are open and accepting of the fact that they're not doing it alone. And then you have other entrepreneurs who really feel like they can't let go. They want to keep control of everything in the company. And as you scale, it's not realistic to have those type of expectations of yourself. And then when you have partners at the table, investors, then communication really comes into play. And it's a relationship situation where you need this investor to be part of your support system. But if you all aren't aligned, then that creates additional stress. If they're providing extra pressure, then you just have someone who you feel like is an adversary when it should be someone who is your number one supporter. So I've seen challenges there. I think that mental health has to be at the forefront, especially because there's the challenges of execution and scale, and then there are the challenges of fundraising as a founder. And a lot of entrepreneurs are dealing with both at the same time, trying to raise capital for their company and grow and scale at the same time. So I think the biggest solution for that is really around team. That's why I'll reiterate what I was saying about making those good hiring decisions early on, because those people are going to shape your experience and how you're able to grow your company. If you don't have the right people, or you're spending a lot of time trying to get rid of people and replace them, you're going to find yourself just constantly drained. And at the end of the day, you know, we're all just sophisticated animals. We're human beings. And as complicated as capital can be, there are fundamental needs that we all have. And as human beings in this industry, we have a psychological way of how we engage with one another that really drives the success in a capitalistic way. And if you don't have that, then it's not sustainable. And so as an investor, I keep that at the forefront in how I'm engaging with founders to make sure that they're good, because if they're not good, it's going to cause a lot of problems down the road. So it's from a place of service. How can I support you? What do you need? If it's just a casual conversation, we don't have to necessarily talk about a board update every time we're having a conversation. It can be, how are your kids? It can be, oh, I remember you said one of your parents was sick. How's that going? And just being a person first and being humanistic in how you operate in the industry. And I think as a founder, if you operate in that way with your team, as well as with your investor, you have a much better experience maintaining your mental health, because you're not feeling like everything falls on you at the end of the day. You're able to leverage your relationships to be able to support your growth.
And you talked about, this is like the second, third time you emphasize team in this aspect. And on the Powered AF podcast, what are some powered tips that you have for someone looking to build this type of team that supports them? Do you have like two or three tips for someone looking to build a team to help them?
So the first tip I would give is to read Ray Dalio's book, Principles. Because I think if you have a foundation of your principles and your values, you're able to better communicate that to the people you're looking to work with. And you can make sure the people you have on your team are a reflection of that. So one, being able to define your values and embody them and be consistent in how you communicate that, so that the people around you are invested in it as well. Because if you're trying to drive a company that other people aren't bought into and they're just there for a check, then you're doing a lot of the heavy lifting by yourself. So Ray Dalio's book, I think, is a great place to start for how to build teams. I think also it's really important to leverage your network and your community and how you're building team, because it's like great people know great people. And I always say that with founders. Whenever people ask me, like, how do you find good deal flow? I ask the founders that I like and respect and trust who they like, respect and trust. And that's the people, that's how I define the community that I surround myself with. Because in some degree, there's a challenge that comes with this, where you end up with a bunch of people who are like you, and you're not getting good diversity of thought or good diversity of experience in who you surround yourself with. But I'm more attentive to that as well. It's like I'm looking for not people who you agree with or people who think the way that you think. I'm more so asking, who do you respect? Who has great character? Who have you seen treat people with kindness and operate with integrity and dignity? Those are the type of people who I'm looking to connect with. And I feel like that has to be the foundation of who you surround yourself with, because otherwise, if you're in a situation where you're working with people who you don't trust, it creates a bunch of turmoil that can be avoided.
Yeah, and I think that's really, really important, because, again, these are other challenges that entrepreneurs have as they're trying to build a business. And a lot of times, these underrepresented founders, they're the first entrepreneurs in their family. And a lot of them don't have examples. So they're trying to figure it out as they go. But when you go and you read the books about, you know, the Steve Jobs and Teslas, you know, the people that people admire, you don't really see any chapters around the toll it takes on them of building something like this, right? right? And what are they doing for balance? You know, what are they, you know, the teams that they lean on, you know, whether people see Steve Jobs as a visionary, it's his team that got him there. And you see books written by his team, you know, that talks about their relationship working with him. Like, yeah, he was hard, but he hired really, really good people around them that really got them to launching some of, you know, the best hardware products that we've ever seen. One of the questions I have for you, do you think entrepreneurs isolate themselves on purpose, or do they believe that's the only way to be successful? Because I don't see necessarily, and I remember reading something that said, I think co-founders have more success than a solo founder, or there's some VCs that only invest if you have a co-founder. And so is that the mentality, especially underrepresented founders? Are they saying, okay, I need to do this by myself, you know, in order to be successful? Is that necessarily true?
From the investor perspective, I do agree that there are a lot of people who believe that you have to have a co-founder in order to have the highest chance of being successful. But I think that really just comes from, like you were saying, the mental health. There's a huge burden that comes with going down this road. And it's easier if you have someone who has a complementary skill set and you're able to cover more ground. In a lot of cases, it just makes more sense. I would also add, and this goes to the question that you asked before, that as a founder, you have to know your flaws. You have to know your weaknesses and be able to seek out those areas in other people so that you're leveraging their strengths to support where you really should be delegating and what's not the best use of your time. And so as an investor and you're evaluating teams, you see that when you have multiple people who are able to have different backgrounds, different experiences, and they're contributing to the company in different ways. When you have one person, that burden all falls on them. And it's not necessarily that you can't be successful as a solo founder. But if you are a solo founder, then as an investor, I'm looking for a strong advisory board. I'm looking for a strong first hire that is able to complement an area where you may not be as strong. So I think that it's more about making sure that all the bases are covered than seeing it as an individual, you're not capable of being successful in the space.
And I think it's really important to understand that, because again, when I look around as an entrepreneur, doesn't have a lot of examples, rather unless I'm reading or now networking with different communities and peers. In my mind, I'm like, okay, maybe I could go faster alone, but that's not necessarily true. You know, there is that saying that says, you know, you could get there faster together, but you need that diverse thoughts, right? You need that in order to really get to where you're trying to go, because there's a lot of things you will not know along the way. Now, people know me for marketing. So, you know, we definitely, before we wrap up, have to touch upon that. And the reason why we talked about raising funding. We talked about, you know, the types of questions you should ask. We talked about building teams. We also touched upon, you said, you know, when you raise money, you then have to go and execute. And so when we're talking about executing, we're talking about selling more, right? We're talking about, you're going to have to market. We're talking about finding newer audiences to get in front of, getting more visibility. And so why is marketing and selling so important, and why should entrepreneurs care? Because a lot of times when you're selling to an existing audience, that may be easy, but now when you have to go into new markets, that's a lot harder. And so you see companies hiring sales teams and agencies. Why is that so critical for entrepreneurs to understand that you're going to need to know how to sell and how to market your product or service business that you're coming out with?
Yeah, well, I mean, the foundation of it is that, you know, selling is how you make money, and making money is how you generate returns and how you eventually get the yacht or whatever, you know, item or just outcome of entrepreneurship makes you feel like you've been successful in the space. I think that marketing is a huge driver of creating the community that supports you. And I know y'all are probably tired of me talking about community and ecosystem and support networks, but those are really the fundamentals of the most successful companies that I've seen. And so I'm always speaking towards that. And when you're marketing, you're telling the story. The biggest component, in my opinion, of marketing is storytelling and your ability to communicate your vision to the people who have a problem that you're looking to solve, or to the people who want to support you in your mission and are aligned with the work that you're doing. And when it comes to venture capital in particular, they speak about this in terms of the problem and the solution. So you're marketing a solution to a problem that exists in a market that has different segments, different types of people, different demographics, and there's a particular segment within that group that you're saying, these are my people. And you have to be able to get really creative about how you reach them and have a good psychological understanding of what's their lifestyle, what challenges are they facing, what do they care about, and how do I reach them through the solutions and the products that I'm offering. And again, people buy with their heart. To a certain degree, they have the logistical, more rational thought processes that they go through to get to the point of making a buying decision. But when you look at companies like Honey Pot, where their community came out and showed out to support them when they had adversaries who didn't want to see them be successful, those type of companies that have that type of community and that type of branding are the ones who jump ahead of the competition, because it's bigger than the dollar. It's really about being invested in the people who run the company and being invested in the mission and the impact. So a lot of the companies that I've worked with, they have a strong value proposition that's rooted in serving others, that's rooted in driving impact. And so that's something that I think aligns with how every founder should be thinking about marketing, having a bigger purpose beyond making money and communicating that to the people who care.
Yeah, it is storytelling, right? And I always tell entrepreneurs, and when you were talking about, you know, what are they reading? You know, what are they doing? That's, you know, in the Power Launch Marketing Accelerator, we call that like the psychographics exercise. Like, we know the demographics, but what's the psychographics of pinpointing exactly who your customers are? And then when you go into business, you have to understand that it's not about you. You know, it's not about you anymore. It's about your customers you're serving. So you're going to have to market. You're going to have to learn how to sell in their language that resonates with them and tell the stories that resonate with them. And I remember seeing what had happened to Honey Pot, and their community came up and showed up for them because they've always cared about their community, because they always marketed and sold from a point of view that, hey, we understand what you're going through. And all we're trying to do is solve the solution of what you're going through and give you another alternative that you could go and shop at that's, you know, safer for you. And so I think that, you know, as you're listening in, again, we talked about, you know, raising funds, but when you raise funds, you then have to execute. When you decide to bootstrap, you have to execute. And you do that through marketing, you do that through selling. And so I thank you for saying that, because this is something I reiterate all the time. And you're saying, even when you raise funds, you still have to do these things.
Yeah, absolutely. The biggest, especially at the early stage, an investor, of course, they're looking at your business model, they're looking at your solution to the problem that you're solving and the market that you're going after, but they're really making an investment in you as a person. And I'm big on founder market fit as an investor. I want to know, who are you and why are you the person to do this? It's bigger than just the solution that you've come up with. And you have to be able to sell me on that, and not sell in a superficial type of way, but you have to be able to get me excited about what you're doing and want to support you. And I'll say it again, we're all sophisticated animals. Like, we're really looking for connection. We're looking for something that makes us feel passionate. We're looking for something that will have impact and will allow us to leave a legacy. And of course, to some degree, there is ego involved in those things too. So you have to appeal to that to really be able to get people excited about the work that you're doing. So finding a way to connect with people and have them see how the work you're doing makes their life better, or how it aligns with the things that they care about. So now they have a motivation to support you that's bigger than, oh, what I'm doing is so great and I'm so smart and this thing that I'm building is so cool.
Right. And I think that sometimes entrepreneurs get held up on that point, right? Looking for the credit. But again, when you start building a business, it's more about who you're serving and how you're serving them as well. This was really, really good. And I'm glad that I had, you know, reached out to you and, you know, started this conversation. And you showed up for me today too, recording this episode. And so thank you for your time, because I know we dropped a lot of gems, we dropped a lot of wisdom, and we sort of gave the listener a roadmap. Hey, here's where you could start. Here are the options that you have right now. And at each stage, here are the types of questions you should ask yourself. And do you want the risk associated, you know, with these decisions and options? And the things you see on Instagram, yes, they should be celebrated, but there's a whole other thing behind the scene when you lift up the curtain that they're also dealing with at the same time. And so thank you so much, Asa, for that. Now, for those listening in that want to learn more about what you're doing, that want to be engaged with you and follow your journey, where could they find you at?
Sure. I'm on Twitter at Jaisaminor, J-A-I-S-A-M-I-N-O-R. That is where I usually post things that I'm up to. I'm also pretty active on LinkedIn. I have an Instagram. One day I'll get better at posting, but my biggest asset in my life is my privacy. And so I prefer to keep a lot of things in real life. But please follow the organizations that I work with and support, HBCUVC, as well as No Miss Ventures. Simeon is the partner for No Miss Ventures, and he's got a lot of great work going on. So anything you're keeping up with him is my journey as well. And then also Juiceheads ATL, if you keep up with them, you'll know what I'm up to there, supporting Atlanta community and bringing health and wellness to people who are on the path and looking to learn more about it. So those are the areas where I'm most active. Also, I think a good way to reach out to me is via email. So if you reach out to me on social media, I'll likely try and connect with you, send you my Calendly link, and we can figure something out.
Right, right. Yeah, send that Calendly link. Don't drop the phone number, email, direct right. email. and definitely make sure, y'all, to check out Juiceheads. Every time I'm in Atlanta, that's literally the number one place I go to, Juiceheads, to. And this ain't an ad or anything for them, but that's really one of my favorite places. I'm actually going there right after
right,
this episode.
Right.
And so thank you so much, listeners, for engaging with us today, today's conversation. And I will see you all during the next show. All right. Have a good one. Thank you for joining us at the Powered AF podcast. Make sure to visit our website and make sure to follow our podcast anywhere you listen to the podcast to make sure you never miss a show. And please, 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 if you enjoyed this episode and this show, please make sure to leave us a review. It really, really does help. And last thing, if you're interested in this freebie that I just released, I want you to check this out. Recently, I put together a free online training on how to 10x your sales online. This is for business owners who are struggling with making consistent sales online. Whether you run a product or service-based business, this is the perfect training for you. The free training is still up, and you can access it by going to poweryourlaunch.com/pod. Again, poweryourlaunch.com/pod. That's P-O-D. All right. Thanks again for listening in. I'll see you during our next show.